Hello and welcome to The Moore Show. I'm your host, Kevin Moore, and for the next hour, I'll cover subjects of an alternative variety that most shows do not touch. On today's show, I'll be joined with Catherine Austin Fitz. Now, Catherine is the founder and president of Solara, and served as managing director and member of board of directors of the Wall Street investment bank, Dillon Reed & Co. She also served as assistant secretary of the Federal Housing Commissioner in the first Bush administration. Catherine has a BA from the University of Pennsylvania and has studied Chinese at the Chinese University of Hong Kong. Catherine, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. It's a privilege.
Just tell the listeners briefly how you became interested in economics and investments.
Well, I, ever since I was very young, I've always been interested in money and investment, kind of my thing. And I, when I was a little girl growing up in Philadelphia in the USA, I kept fretting about the fact that things didn't seem to work very well. And whenever I would ask someone why something didn't work well, they would explain to me the reason was money. So I thought, well, you know, what is this money thing and why does it keep everything from working? And so my theory was I'm going to learn how all the money in the world works and then figure out why money can't work for us instead of just not working against us. And I ended up on Wall Street, and what I discovered when I was on Wall Street is that all the knowledge about money is sort of chopped up into little areas of expertise. And if you wanted to map out the financial ecosystem of whether it's your, you know, the community in which you live or the sort of environmental ecosystem in which you live or your country or the globe, it's very difficult. You know, if you're an integrated picture and you want a simple integrated picture of how the money works, it's a challenge. And so I became intensely interested with how we could understand money contiguous to places and sort of align money with the needs of living people and things. Right now, the financial system is used to permit a few people to control many in a way that is, I would say, less than wonderful. And my estimate, I have a little Solari Circle, which is an investment club, and one day we decided we would figure out how to reoptimize all the wealth on planet Earth. And one of the things we asked each other was, if we were free as a culture, as a civilization, to just optimize total wealth, whether that's living wealth or environmental wealth or financial wealth, how much wealth could we create relative to what it is now? And we realized that my estimate of current wealth was that it was 1% of what was possible. And so I'm very interested in how we can change the financial system from something that allows the few to control the many to a system that really helps us build wealth in very collaborative ways. So that's how this got to be, sort of a passion and a full-time business and job.
Okay, so stock markets are looking better. Do we have anything to worry about over here? And is the monetary system now working?
Well, you're watching, in the U.S., you're watching the financial system go through very significant change. In fact, I call it a financial coup d'etat. But we're watching a financial system that was operating contiguous to a country go to a financial system that's operating contiguous to a planet. So, think of the central bank and treasury here in the United States as being a financial mechanism that's managing the reserve currency for the world, which is the dollar. And that reserve currency has become, Kevin, a taxation system that literally raises taxes from around the world. What we do is we sell treasury securities or Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and Ginnie Mae's or other agency securities to countries, and then the value of that paper goes down, and that's a taxation system through the balance sheet. And if you look at how the system works, actually, it's funny because in the United States we have people, a variety of people who think that the United States is really run from the City of London in the UK. And, you know, then when I was just in London this summer, and, everybody there thinks it's run from Washington. But, in fact, if you look at this sort of global financing and taxation system, it is very much what's called the Anglo-American Alliance, which has been, if you look at whether it's the city or New York and Wall Street, a remarkable amount of the financial system has been run through run through those two financial centers. And now what we're watching is a shift. It's what people call rebalancing from a economy which is driven by the first world, so Europe and the United States and some of Asia, to one which is rebalanced with the emerging markets. So we're going from a consumer society driven by the American consumer to consumer society rebalanced to the emerging market consumers, particularly in Asia. And we're going from a world where the U.S. stocks trade at really extraordinarily high PEs and low dividend yields relative to stocks globally, and I would include the European stocks as well, to one where the emerging markets are coming up in value. So we're literally watching a rebalancing of currency, of markets, from the first world nations who now have aging populations to the populations that have young and growing population. And that's tracking what happened in the 90s with the changes in GATT and the institution of the World Trade Organization. You know, this rebalancing process is very much driven by that change in rules and a shift from the Western economies depending on labor in the West to the Western economies really exploiting labor globally with much more freedom than they had before. So what you're watching is a basic reengineering of the economy and the financial system with it.
What about all this talk about a double-dip recession worldwide?
Well, I sort of have a hard time talking about using the sort of market language and framework. What you've got is you've got an economy of insiders and outsiders. I call it the tapeworm economy. And we're watching a steady centralization of control of the global economy. So we're watching the insiders get richer and richer, and the outsiders get played against each other and get poorer and poorer. And the way that process has been managed in the United States, as soon as the Uruguay round of GATT went in, you watched a tremendous amount of capital, I estimate over $10 trillion before the bailouts, leaving North America to be reinvested in emerging markets. And that process was facilitated by an enormous bubble, which unfortunately got a lot of Americans thinking that they were much better off as they were. As the value of their home and other assets bubbled up, they didn't notice that their equity was being drained off. And now that bubble's over, and you're watching people worldwide adjust to, a pretty, in some places, very ugly adjustment. Now, so if you come to the United States, the economy is slow to very slow, in a depression for the outsiders. Things are reasonably okay for the insiders. But you've got to reconcile an enormous bureaucracy of business and federal, state, and local government to a world with significantly less revenues because of this kind of engineering. So you're sort of leaving the bubble and going back to something that is less bubbled. Now, that's a tricky adjustment, again, because you're trying to keep the corporate business is going on the global consumer rather than the American consumer, so it's kind of a tricky management. But I think my guess is we're going to see things pick up here in the fall. That's not going to change things for outsiders. I mean, we're basically watching a similar process both in the UK and the United States, is the middle class being engineered out of existence. The middle class here is struggling with rising expenses, particularly food and essential expenses, and falling income. And that process is going to continue. But what we're going to watch is the corporations and the insiders being protected. And the tricky thing, Kevin, in this whole rebalancing effort is the U.S. economy is much more dependent on government, federal government subsidy than most people believe. You can break America down into 3,100 counties. And if you go into each county, what you'll be stunned if you map out the financial ecosystems by county, how many people and businesses and organizations are entirely dependent on appropriations from the federal government. And that's why we've become so dependent on this sort of global taxation system, because it's the global taxation system that's basically sort of paying everybody's rent. Throughout America, we now have more than 50% of the households almost direct, you know, I would describe as directly dependent on government checks.
Sure.
So it's very much a, you know, economically, I would say that the communist countries won the war, because we have a very centralized government subsidized economy. And that's why sort of the military, at this point, the thing driving the U.S. economy is the military, because it's the military that's making it possible for people around the world to buy treasury and treasury-related securities and basically finance this.
Right. Well, we'll get into that in a bit. We'll definitely get into the military aspect of the economy and where we're going with that. But would you say, then, that this financial system is being falsely propped up, then? And if it goes next time, it's really going to go, isn't it, I suppose?
Well, it's a politically managed system. It's not a market-based system. That's why it can be so challenging to try and describe it with market-based terminology. But it's a very politically managed economy. And I noticed you just had Nick Pope on the show. One of the issues that makes it such a centrally managed economy, even more centralized, is that particularly in the U.S., but it's a global phenomena, we've had a huge infrastructure built up. The Washington Post just did a series and called it Secret America. I published the Solari Report, and we just had Richard Dolan on the Solari Report talking about his wonderful book, UFOs and the National Security State, the second volume in that three-volume series. And Richard describes a breakaway civilization. If you go back to the end of World War II, we created in the United States, with the National Security Act and the CIA Act and then a series of executive orders, we created a financing mechanism that allowed government borrowing essentially to finance private corporations, privatizing, you know, secret technology and building some of the most powerful technology in the planet and the most advanced technology. And that sort of that privatized national security state dealing with the UFO phenomena and the most advanced technology has just grown and grown and grown, and it's unbelievably expensive. You know, I would argue that the greatest the greatest use of the bailout money was to refinance out fraudulent securities, particularly mortgage securities, used to finance that national security state, what I call the black budget. So part of this centralization and part of this, enormously expensive and financial system is this big, this big secret infrastructure and all the money going to it. And the challenge economically is that it then manages a system and a culture and a civilization which frankly sub-optimizes wealth. I said when we started, I think the wealth on planet Earth is less than 1% of what it could be. And I think part of it is we're struggling with the expense of, keeping so many secrets as a society and running things on a very centralized, non-democratic, non-market principle basis. And I think we've reached the point where the multiple personality disorder of the politics is really destroying the economy. I mean, if you look at the United States, the big engine, our big economic engine, aside from the military, has been small business and venture capital, and yet the government is doing everything it can do to stop capital from flowing to small business and to regulate small business and tax it into the ground. So,
sure. I mean, what's happened?
Because capital is being centralized and preserved for the black budget.
I mean, what's happened with small business in America? I mean, what are the people on the ground saying about small business?
Well, small business, if you look at employment, small business, again, outside of the military, has been, since 1985, has been the, you know, that's where the jobs have come from. But if you look at taxation, regulation, you know, different policies, small business has just, I think the government has done just about everything they can to discourage small business. When I was, I had an investment bank in Washington in the 90s, and we were financing, we were prototyping community venture funds to channel equity capital to small business. One of small business's chief problems is it's dependent on either retained earnings or bank financing for financing. And what small business really needs to do is to be competitive on cost of capital. But we're in a society where all the capital is being flowed to Wall Street and the black budget. So, for example, if you're Goldman Sachs or Morgan Stanley, you can use the federal credit. You've got FDIC insurance to, borrow money very cheaply. For a long time, you had the yen carry trade. You could basically borrow from the Japanese Central Bank for almost nothing. So you have a cost of capital of sort of 0 to 1%. And if for any reason, and you take that government-guaranteed money, in essence, and then turn around and use it to do very high-risk trading like derivatives and proprietary trading, if anything goes wrong, the government bails you out. So you have basically, a 0% cost of capital while a small business is having to earn after-tax profits to get its capital. So you're borrowing at 0%, and the Hickory Valley meat market's borrowing at 30%. And it doesn't take long to figure out that the guy who can borrow at 0% can start all sorts of franchises in big box stores and basically out-compete small business, because it's an extraordinary differential in cost of capital. And frankly, it's being engineered by subsidized government money.
Yeah, of course it is.
So we're doing everything we can to channel capital to the insiders. And you see, Kevin, you see this discussion when the G20 gets together and the transformation from G8 to G20, because around the world we have numerous countries and institutions that need currency and need the financial system to make the real economy go. And yet the real economy has been put on hold while we use the financial system for financial speculation and all sorts of shenanigans. And there's a real war going on planet Earth right now. Are we going to use our currency and our financial system to build a real economy, or are we just going to use it to play games?
Yeah, of course. I mean, one of the main ripple effects in the UK was the subprime market. Now, in the US, has the home foreclosures due to the subprime market stopped? Is it higher or lower right now?
Well, remember, the subprime mortgage market was really a financial fraud situation. It was not a mortgage. There's an enormous disconnect between what's going on in the real world and the real economy and what you see in securitized mortgage paper. So, for example, I served in the first Bush administration as Assistant Secretary of Housing, and we saw neighborhoods where a house was financed and refinanced five times in a year. And what I've said, I believe now, based on a variety of different sources of information, is, literally 10 mortgages were being issued on one house. So, for example, when the bailouts came along and we gave Wall Street $12 trillion, that's more than enough money to pay off all the residential mortgages in America 100%. So, the mortgage market represented by the securitized paper that global investors invested in there are a lot of mortgages in there that, if I'm right, there's no houses that exist. There's a major fraud spread between the paper that people are buying around the world and what's happening in neighborhoods on the ground. But there's no doubt that enormous amounts of mortgages were originated for which there were no people who could afford to pay them, or who understood what they had just agreed to, or there were no people, or there were no houses. So, and yet it was extraordinary, Kevin, because here I am. I was the former Assistant Secretary of Housing, and for years trying to warn people about what was happening and how fraudulent the paper was. And what was interesting is, I have a column over in New Zealand, and it's spoken in Europe and New Zealand, and everybody just kept buying the paper because they assumed it didn't really matter what was behind it. They just figured Wall Street would make good on it, or the U.S. government would make good on it. And I think 2008 was a shock because people realized, maybe they might not make good on it.
That's right.
We might be left holding the bag. And, maybe it's not such a good idea to buy paper and not care about what's really in it.
Well, I mean, in this next bubble to go, I mean, if there is a next bubble to go, I mean, the U.S., the commercial sector, I heard, is not doing too well right now. I mean, I was listening to an American talk show just a few days ago, and they were mentioning quite big company names. I mean, one of them was Blockbusters, for example, and some other ones soon to file for bankruptcy. I mean, how bad is the commercial sector in the U.S. right now?
Well, I would say that, how do I put this? When I used to be a partner in a Wall Street firm, I was a member of the board of directors of Dillon Reed. And once upon a time, I used to, when I picked up an annual report of a major company, I assumed that their financial statements represented what was really happening. And the reality is, today, based on my personal experiences with the top accounting firms and with the corporate situations where I've investigated problems, when I pick up an annual report, I view it the way I view a good work of fiction. Now, that doesn't mean that every annual report is fiction, but we've reached a state where the real economy and a symbolic economy as represented by annual financial statements and other things are now so divorced, that the system fundamentally does not have integrity. Now, if you're an investor sitting in the UK, what does that mean to you? Well, many investors take the position that the government financial mechanism is there to support and make good on the myth. And I think that's a question in many people's minds. We've watched tremendous withdrawals of equity, retail equity investment from the stock market over the last 17 weeks. It's outflows of the retail capital reported each week. You can see the latest report up on my blog at solari.com/blog. And I think that's because what you're watching is fundamentally a lack of faith in the integrity of the system, and the extent to which, we're watching. And one of the things that most concerns me as an investment advisor is I really do believe in diversification. And yet, if you look at a portfolio of companies, of sort of first world companies, more and more what you're really watching is companies that are propped up with government purchases or government subsidies or government contracts or dependent on businesses or consumers that are propped up with the same. And so you're not looking at a diversified portfolio. You might as well be buying all U.S. treasuries as a credit matter. So, you know, this is what happens when you centralize the economy through the governmental mechanism. You end up with mythic annual reports and companies that really are simply just a government contractor. They're not really diversified in an economic sense.
But don't you feel, though, sometimes, Catherine, that, you know, if you keep pushing people, you know, by raising bills, you know, that even companies can't afford as well, don't you increase the risk of, you know, people becoming unrestful? I mean, there's, you know, lots of jobs come from small businesses and, you know, they're being hit hard, as we spoke about before. I mean, what do you think about people's attitude towards this?
Well, I think that, you know, if you look at what Richard Dolan calls the breakaway civilization, I really don't think they care. I think they have sufficient technology. You know, there's 6.5 billion people on Earth, and you can, for 500 years, we've now been operating on what I call the central banking warfare model, and it's a sort of wonderful framework for the economy that I first got from James Turk, who's the founder of Gold Money. And the central banking warfare model, if it's going to continue, given the way things are going, you know, there are two ways, there's sort of two things we can do. In the central banking warfare model, the central banks print money, and then the military intelligence and a variety of overt and covert force mechanisms force people to take the paper and provide cheap access to natural resources. And the central banking model has been unbelievably successful. It's the real power behind the Anglo-American alliance, including on the military side, the ability of the Navy to manage and control the sea lanes. And so, you know, and it's given us the ability to control the reserve currency. It's been, as an economic matter, it's been a huge success as a matter of culture and civilization. I think people, you know, there are a lot of people who would object to the extent to which genocide and forest theft of natural resources has gone on. So we have this central banking warfare model, and if you're going to keep it going, you have to get to keep the central banking warfare model, you're going to have to depopulate. So if you've got 6.5 billion going to 9 billion people on planet Earth, you can keep the central banking model going, but only by centralizing, reducing a lot of the middle class to poverty and depopulating. And that's sort of the trajectory we're headed on, and I call it the slow burn, because every time you'll hear a variety of market pundits say that the market and the economy is going to crash, what they don't appreciate is you can infinitely subsidize financial assets in the fundamental system by simply liquidating people and their assets, as opposed to letting financial assets drop in value. And that's literally what happened. The inside subsidizing themselves at the expense of the outsiders, and that's what we're watching. You know, the alternative, which I think is important, is because I think there's an alternative vision, is to implement a lot of the technology that's available and on the shelf and really change the model to one which is much more market-based principles. And, you know, I have a lot of thoughts on what that involves and how we can do it. And it starts with rebuilding local economies and having a financial system that really does support and energize the real economy. But I think that, you know, the insiders who have the most powerful weaponry kind of feel that they value control more than equity valuations, and they would be happier to continue the central banking warfare model. And I think that, you know, the issue, Kevin, is I believe that they have the financial or they have the weaponry and the power to institute the slow burn all the way down to a much smaller population. If you look at the invisible weaponry, the non-lethal weapons, I think they have the ability, and they think they have the ability to do it. If you look at the recent surveys of sort of the political class here in America, they're very happy about where things are and think the country's headed in the right direction. So I think they're pretty smug with their ability to control centrally. And now, you know, my prediction is that ultimately I think they're going to fail. because I don't think force is the basis of holding together a planetary civilization, and I don't think, I don't think that a gun is sufficient to create the global respect you need to stay in control and in charge, but obviously the leadership and I disagree on that.
Of course it is. This sort of moves to my next question then, I suppose. I mean, is the US trying to move sort of over to a digital currency? And why is this a bad thing as well?
Well, here's the problem. The basis of individual sovereignty is privacy and the ability to keep data about yourself private. And the question is, the ultimate question, Nicholas Negroponte, when he ran the Media Lab, said in a digital age, data about money is worth more than money. And if we go to a digital currency, particularly if it's a fiat currency where a central authority basically controls the data on all the digital transactions, you're looking at a world of absolutely total control. you're talking about a central authority who literally has the ultimate in the insider information and can insider trade everybody else all day long. So to me, I think it's a dreadful idea because it's the ultimate in a financial system where there's no optimization. You know, market principles really cannot go to work because you've got one guy who's, can rig the deal. A little bit like, having your currency system run by the folks in Las Vegas. Anyway, so, I think it's a terrible idea. Now, if you look at, I posted up on my blog this week a wonderful little story about the United States Post Office is now pricing its international mailing, not just in dollars, but in the IMF's FDR's the special drawing rights, which is a basket of currencies, so it's the pound, the euro, the yen, the dollar, and I think if I was interested in sort of tracking the development of a global currency, I would very much watch the IMF and the FDR system. And if you look at what's happening at the G20 meetings, what you're seeing is countries that really are trying to transact and build a real economy, and a vibrant real economy. I would suggest Brazil's economy, for example, is very vibrant. They're struggling, again, trying to deal with a financial system which has been, in recent years, designed more for financial speculation and bubbles and profits than in serving the real economy. And I think that a variety of people are trying to make the SDR system go and address that question. Now, whether it will work, I don't know. My feeling is until you have a system globally where we can have both global and local currencies without a few players being able to control the data and digital access in sort of, non-transparent and criminal ways, I don't see how we get there. But that's going to be at the heart of the struggle.
I mean, you mentioned before about the money it's costing to keep the war in Afghanistan going and Iraq. Well, where's the money coming from? Both our countries are contributing to keep the war in Afghanistan going, and there's some 50,000 troops that will stay on in Iraq as well. Where's this coming from?
Well, it's coming from running the financial mechanism that I described. In other words, what we've instituted through the balance sheet is a global taxation system. So the United States and to a lesser extent the UK issue securities. They issue government borrowing, and then they spend that money to occupy Afghanistan and Iraq, etc. And then the value of the securities that they've issued go down in value. And so the legislatures around the world, the central banks around the world, nobody has to pass a law saying we're going to pay a tax to the Anglo-American Alliance. Instead, they just buy the paper and it goes down in value. So let's say you're a third world nation. I give you treasury securities, and I sell you treasury securities, and I get the money, and I use that money to buy your natural resources, which are rising in value while my paper is falling in value. you know, and so I get your natural resources, and then the paper goes down in value through the inflation mechanism, and you've just paid me a tax.
Sure, and again, like you said, you know, we're so addicted to the oil. You know, there are alternative energies out there, which you've were sort of touching on before.
Well, here's the problem. If you're going to control the reserve currency, then you need to control one or more of the primary assets in the planet that has an inelastic demand. So think of controlling the reserve currency, which is on the monopoly board, is the power position. You need to have an asset to back up that reserve currency. So for the central banking model, central banking warfare model to work, you need guns, but you also need to control the asset trade. That's why one of the reasons the Navy and the control of the sea lanes has been so important is because of the ability to control oil and insist that it be traded in our reserve currency. So if you're going to change the currency, and or if you're going to institute alternative energy, then the question is, what's going to be the asset that controls or supports the new digital currency? And I would suggest there's tremendous effort by the Anglo-American Alliance to get control of the seed system, to integrate the copyright laws with the patenting of seed and basically food, and industrialize the food production and distribution system in a way which reflects the kind of control of the food system that we've had of the oil and gas system. And my question is that because they need a replacement for oil to maintain the reserve currency?
Yeah, sure. I mean, to sort of summarize this up then, in your views, you would say that this sort of debt has been engineered to coordinate more control on the people, would you say?
Right. It's the debt system is not a financial system as most people think of it. It's a governance system. It's a control system. And it's being used to centralize control of the economy and put control very tightly into the banker and financial interests. So it's just not a financial system. If you look at the majority of the debt in the United States at this point, the governmental debt, it wouldn't surprise me if more than half of it was issued outside the laws of constitution and the laws related to the issuance of debt. And, you know, we've seen other instances in the United States where debt improperly issued is abrogated because it's not constitutionally authorized and properly issued. And it's a theoretical question at best, but you know, I mean, I have real questions as to how much of this debt is legal. I also have real questions about how much of the debt is on balance sheet, you know, because there's lots of indications that, you know, that debt is outstanding that has not been recorded on the balance sheet. The federal government was required by law to produce audited financial statements as of 1995, and to this day has never done it. And we know from the sort of the efforts, the reports that reported that they haven't done it, you know, they're serious questions, and I've suggested, and there's a page up on my website called The Missing Money. There's literally trillions of dollars missing from the federal government. So I that's why I go back to Richard Dolan's concept of the breakaway civilization. We really have reached a point where our official picture of reality financially is so different than our reality. You know, that the time has come for a major period of transparency, because the financial multiple personality disorder at this point has become so dysfunctional and so wealth destructing that we really need we need more than a debt jubilee. We need a secret jubilee.
Yeah, true. Well, one thing we need is transparency. I mean, if we had more transparency and more of a oneness towards each other, then surely this financial mess would never have happened.
Well, if the banking system was more transparent, number one, if the political system was more transparent, you know, I really do think we need the national security state to come out into the... We need some more sunshine there. The other thing, though, is, Kevin, that the average person needs to take greater responsibility for how our money works. You know, in the culture in the United States, I am ethically responsible for my actions. So what I do, you know, where I go, how I treat people, I'm ethically responsible. But in the United States, we all believe we can finance the most horrible practices in the world and make money on it and still be ethical. So there's a complete denial as to where our money's going and how we're making our money and the source of our many blessings. And I think what we're coming into a change, and it's going to be a global change, where people say, you know something, as a cultural matter, I'm not only responsible for my own actions, I'm responsible for the actions I finance. You know, that I tell the red button story, which is a story about I was giving a speech to a group of people called the Spiritual Frontiers Foundation, and I asked them who in the audience would push a red button if it would stop all hard narcotics trafficking in their community, their neighborhood, their state tomorrow. And out of 100 people dedicated to evolving our society spiritually, 99 would not push the button because it would offend the people who control the money, basically financing government deficits and putting the money in the stock market. And they felt, you know, that they were not prepared to stop narcotics trafficking in their community if it meant that their 401ks and IRAs and mutual funds crashed in value, or if their government checks stopped. And that's that's kind of a metaphor for the fact that as a society, we have all been the beneficiary of the Anglo-American Alliance's success at exploiting the world. And so this is not just the elites. This is all of us. We are all complicit in this model, and I think if we're going to change out of the central banking warfare model, we need to go to a world where each one of us not only gets the transparency we need to know what the impact of both our actions and our financial actions and transactions are, but we need to take responsibility. So it's going to require a much greater level of responsibility as a cultural matter, because the ultimate question is who enforces. And when the most powerful people on the planet have unbelievably powerful, weaponry, including invisible weaponry, the only way to outdo that is with broad-based responsibility taking in terms of, you know, if they're a bad actor, then I won't put money in their bank, I won't deposit with them, I won't invest in them, I won't transact in them. It's the ultimate passive-aggressive strategy. Withdraw and avoid and refuse to give energy to the people who behave in ways that you don't want to see, you know, your planet run according to those principles.
Sure. It's kind of like saying...
That's a very deep change.
Yeah, it's kind of like saying, you know, we're the good guys. I'm going to pull out all my money from this bank or financial institution or whatever because it's, behaved in a way that, that we wouldn't want to do to another. So, we're not going to deal with them. And that is another way of, attacking the problem, isn't it?
Right, because ultimately the issue, you can pass all the laws you want, but the question is who's going to enforce them? And the reality is up against this kind of weaponry and power, the only enforcement mechanism that can be effective and last is one where every person on the planet says, I'm responsible for enforcement in who I give energy to. So if somebody's a bad actor, I'm going to withdraw. I'm not going to associate with them. I'm not going to admire them. I'm not going to watch their media. I'm not going to put money in their banks. I'm not going to buy from them. I'm going to do everything I can to avoid them. Every one of us is going to have to enforce and take responsibility to enforce, because it's the only system that's going to work. It's the only one that's going to be effective.
I mean, you mentioned the Federal Reserve bailout there. Where did that $2 trillion that the Federal Reserve lent out to the banks go?
Well, actually, the total bailouts is $12 trillion and counting. And that's the great mystery. Where did it go? My theory is that it refinanced out the fraudulent paper that was used to basically engineer the financial coup d'etat. So, for example, if I'm right about the securities fraud involved in financing the housing bubble, I think a lot of the bailouts refinanced out the paper that was issued. So think of it as like an LBO of a country. You issue, phony baloney paper, then you take over the company, then you use the company's cash to refinance out the phony baloney paper. So it's literally an LBO of the country. And if you said to me, well, where did the original money on the securities went? I think it went to a variety of places, but I think the biggest chunk of it, Kevin, went to the black budget. I mean, I agree with Richard Dolan. I think we're financing secret space programs and all sorts of, I think some of these UFOs flying around are coming from Lockheed Martin. So, and it's an extraordinarily expensive undertaking, what's going on. And the reason we need to know about it is that's the technology that can build incredible wealth in our society. So there are, we don't have an economic problem. We have a political problem. And part of our political problem is the politicians who control the private interests that control the black budget are hoarding that technology in a way that, if we unhoarded it in an appropriate way, we could preserve a middle class, not just in the first world, but, let other people enjoy the benefits of, sort of middle and a life where they're not just scrounging to survive.
If the monetary system's not worked and, we're not able to fix it, should it be allowed to collapse?
I would much prefer a currency system which was much more emergent. So, for example, at the end of the Great Depression, there were 3,100 community currencies in America, which is exactly how many counties there are in America. So, I'm somebody who has always hoped that collapse would happen because I think, I would much rather be part of a sort of organic society building up from collapse than one that was being run as a corporate fascist state with a world government. I think the chances of collapse are very unlikely. I just don't think, because again, I don't think we have a financial system. People who think the system's going to collapse think that the current financial system is operating as a financial system, and I don't think it's operating as a financial system. I think it's operating as a control system. I also think we don't have any economic problems. 100% of our problems are political, and they ultimately, as an economic matter, they come down to, how much technology is going to be shared with how many people, and how many people are going to be allowed to live and function on planet Earth. And again, as you centralize the economy, you destroy wealth and you shut the blood off from circulating. So I think we've got a centralization disease, not an economic problem.
So for people working right now, listening to this show, what should they do? Should they be saving?
Well, first of all, if it's possible for you to get out of debt, I would absolutely get out of debt. But think of it this way. You have these large organizations called governments and large corporations, and right now they're operating on a business model that says they don't have your best interests at heart. So they make money by selling you food that's not healthy or doing other things that are just not good for you. And so you have to operate on the premise that in a court of law under our system, people are innocent until proven guilty. But in the court of corporate transactions, you should assume that banks and corporations and large governments are guilty until proven innocent. It's the opposite standard. And you just need to accept that we're trying to navigate a system where we have a whole lot of power and money that are basically lying and not telling us the truth. And once you get over the overwhelm of that, the first thing you need to do is withdraw from corporate media and start getting your media from trustworthy sources. So if they're listening to your show, Kevin, then they already know to do that. But the first thing we need, you know, if we're gonna be free, then we need our minds to be free. So get away from corporate media. You know, turn off your television set. Get away from media that just doesn't tell you the truth. So number one is sort of clean the lies out of your mind. Number two is start to bank or manage your transactions. Some people are lucky enough to be able to avoid banks. So, you know, so get out of the banking system or get into a bank or credit union or savings bank or other depository institution where you know the people, they know you, and they have real integrity. Number three, do everything you can to create privacy, or if you're using systems, you know, I use email and the internet every day, just understand that none of that information is private. The intelligence agencies have extraordinary access to all that kind of information. You just need to know that and, you know, live your life in a way that you'd be happy for everybody to see everything. Because as a financial matter, when you use those systems, you're naked. Then you need to understand that your purchase is a vote. So, you know, if you vote for, if you go to a store that you know is behaving in very unethical ways, then you're voting for that. You're giving it energy. So try over time to engineer your purchases into entities that you are proud of what they're doing and how they're functioning. Same with your donations. Do everything you can to decentralize your donations and give and support charities where you really can see, you know the people and you can see on an intimate basis what they're doing. A lot of charities are really just fronts to channel capital into big endowments that finance the kind of activities none of us want to be associated with. So be very, very careful about where your donations go. And then finally, your investments. I mean, you want to stay as far away from the people who can play games with you and hiccup you. Now, the problem is it's a very interdependent global system, but there are ways to be conservative and protect yourself. And as we go from sort of this bubble economy to rebuilding a real economy and rebalancing of the global economy, you can position yourself to be in the parts of the real economy that are going to add real value and are going to grow over the next 10 or 20 years. I've got an audio seminar called Position Your Assets for Growth in Uncertain Times, and we have a precious metals dealership, and we love to, we can't sell to people in the UK, but we certainly love to talk to you and are happy to share our thoughts and ideas about how to use precious metals. So, so call us and talk to us if you want. But, you know, there are lots of things you can do, but you need to stay away from doing business or investing in people who are behaving this way or, you know, who are building okay. the kind of world that you don't want your children and grandchildren to be part of.
Okay.
So across the board in everything we do, Kevin, and if it's in our actions and transactions, withdraw from the unhealthy and then invest in the healthy, but in a way which is energizing for you, because the problem we all have is we're being drained by this, and what we need to do is reverse the drain. And that's why it's so important, the quality of the people that you're associated with, whether it's directly in your actions or indirectly, but get out of dependency on the financial system and get out of dependency on the bad dogs.
But I mean, if you've got to go, you know, if you've got no choice but to go bankrupt, then I suppose it's not the road you really want to go down, because it affects your credit rating very much long term. But I mean, you know, if you're going to have to go bankrupt, what would you say to that? Would you advise going bankrupt?
It depends on your particular situation, you know, so I hate to give blanket recommendations, but I would say this, if you are through bankruptcy, if you're basically stiffing the large financial institutions, I would say, you know, they've stolen infinitely more from you than you'll ever sock back to them, so feel free to sock it back. You know, I really don't care about my credit rating. I want to be as far away from the financial system and anything that would care about those ratings. You know, I just think that's a way of those guys holding you hostage. And I basically think these institutions have stolen a great deal of money from every citizen of the planet, and I think any time you can stick it back to them, you know, if that's what's effective and good for you, have at it.
Okay, so you've mentioned there about avoiding investing in corrupt institutions, but what about networking with neighbours and embarking on DIY projects and buying from local farmers? I mean, that must be a way to enhance local wealth.
Right. The one of the most important things we all need to do is to make sure that the food we're eating is fresh and healthy. And what we're watching and have watched since the early 90s is unbelievable deterioration in the quality of the food system. I mean, at this point, corporate food is often just not safe. And so anything you can do, you come into our website, our tagline is, who's your farmer, who's your banker, where's your money? And I think there's nothing more important than knowing the people who grow and make your food and trying to establish and encourage local food sources. And if you have the financial wherewithal to do it, finding opportunities to invest in financing local farmers and local food supply. You know, ultimately, Kevin, investing is the strategic provision of the resources we need. And so, we've been trained to sort of invest in the stock market, get a dividend, and then go over and buy food at the company store. Well, you know, we're going to have to evolve a new model which says, I'm going to use my investment to lock up the access to the quality food and water that I need. So where it's appropriate, finding opportunities, networking locally to find the fresh food sort of culture and society around you is fun and wonderful, and ultimately we're going to need to be finding ways of switching our investments to make sure that we have the food and water that we and our families need.
Well, you are right. I mean, our food supply has deteriorated, and we should be looking at growing our own, definitely.
Well, we should be looking at growing our own if we can. If you're a busy person with a bunch of kids and lots of responsibilities, maintaining a garden is a lot of work. What we can do is, for those who are interested, I really encourage taking some permaculture courses. And the permaculturalists are doing wonderful things with edible landscapes and edible forests. For any of us who have a home with a bit of green where we have trees or landscape, there's no reason why we can't convert those landscapes to really sources of food. And it's amazing if you can imagine if all of our front yards and our trees were bearing fruit and nuts. It's amazing how much food we could get just from our sort of landscape.
Okay, so you must see some sort of light at the end of the tunnel in all this.
Oh, I do. My light at the end of the tunnel is, for 500 years we've had this central banking warfare model. It has to change. And the pro-centralization team has a vision of what that change should look like, and I think their vision is complete bunk and won't work. And, my concern is before it fails, it could do an awful lot of damage. And I think it is the responsibility of the rest of us to say, look, we're not interested in becoming slaves in the black budget, vision of the world. How do we emerge a new model? And I think that's why, your show and shows like yours, what we're doing with the Solari Report is so important, because those of us who don't want a centralized model, who prefer a decentralized model, one that's much more based on enlightened principles of democratic process and market principles, we need a vision of an alternative model, and we need to prototype and try it. And so it's incumbent on all of us to invent it. And that's a huge conversation, and it's got to be a global conversation, because the central banking warfare model has been a global model, and the new model to be successful is going to have to be emergent and one that we share, not just legally and financially, but culturally. So the conversation has begun. You know, what's the model going to look like and how do we invent it together?
Okay, how do people get in contact with yourself and what's your website?
My website is Soleri.com. We have a blog at Soleri.com blog, or you can just come into Soleri, S-O-L-A-R-I.com, and click on the blog. And we have a precious metals dealership for those in North America. We sell in the United States, all states but Tennessee, Soleri Silver and Gold. And you can find it on the blog. We have a wonderful, Kevin, calculator. You can click on the little logo for the silver and gold calculator. And we're hoping to encourage communities to start to use their precious metals as a currency. And you can click on any one of about 20 different currencies. And it's a little calculator that will help you calculate back and forth between silver and gold and the fiat currency that you've chosen. And so that's a tool that's there. And then I published the Soleri Report, which is a briefing, a private briefing that I do for subscribers by phone, on sort of it's personal financial planning and information for people who really know what's going on and want to know what's going on. Not everybody does, but for people who really want to know what's going on, it's basically a sort of a personal financial approach for. We have a section called Money and Markets, and then one called Ask Catherine. Then we do interviews with sort of people I think are the smartest people around about what's going on in finance and health and the things that are driving politics, both globally and locally. And then we have a section I love called Let's Go to the Movies, because I find the best way of explaining what's really going on is through the movies. You know, we're all working hard and reading thousands of books is difficult, so I like to use the movies and documentaries to help teach about what's really going on.
Well, Catherine, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you on, and, I want you to come back in the future.
Oh, I'd love to, Kevin. Listen, I think what you're doing is great, so keep leading that global conversation, and just let me know. I'd love to be back again. You're doing great stuff.
To find out more information on Catherine, go to themoreshow.co.uk and look up Catherine Austin Fitz under past guests. So until next time, be safe.